The educated slave becomes fractious. Train an apprentice, you train a competitor. A well-read citizen is critical of the policies of his government. A widely read communicant disputes the authority and the doctrine of his priest. The child who is trained beyond the intellectual horizons of his parents becomes an alien in his home. Education, dear friends, is subversive. Education is abrasive of the social order. And so it is that throughout history, the organized institutions of society have organized themselves to limit the schooling and the education available to the masses, to the minorities. Of course, you must train a field hand to perform the simple tasks of agriculture. Of course, you must train the townsfolk to do the noxious tasks, but no more. Of course, the rationalization always is that a richer intellectual diet would be too much for their rude mental palates. Now, what is true of nations is true of families. The young man who has been trained beyond the attitudes and the traditions of his home becomes a stranger in his own home. He lacks the ability to understand and to be understood. There are some African tribes in which the young person who goes to the mission school or to the city school is actually danced out of the tribe upon his admission. They know that he has become someone else, that he will never again be one of them. And the rationalization, of course, to the adult world, to the family, is that education is confusing and misleading. Where is that young man whom you shined up and dressed up for Sunday school, who knew what was right and what was wrong, in that disheveled, unkempt youngster who comes back from college? Obviously, there's something at the university in education which is corrupt, corrosive, confusing. We want to protect our youngsters in their innocence. I suspect that could we sum up the actions of men over the course of history, we would find, to our surprise, I believe, that far more were busy denying learning than encouraging it. It's been estimated that in the Roman Empire, less than 5% of the population was literate. Certainly in the colonial empires of Asia and of Africa, the number was far less. Oh, a few native princes were brought up in private schools and sent on to Oxford and to the Sorbonne and welcomed into the establishment. And there was a small percentage of the population that was trained to manage the minor bureaus and to be the functionaries of the administration. But beyond that, the colonial powers had very little interest in raising up the intellectual sights of the masses. After all, knowledge is power. Those who have privilege are not about to raise up their rivals and speed their victory. The establishment in the United States knew exactly what it was about when 50 or 60 years ago it imposed rigid quotas on Jews and on Catholics entering the better schools and the professional schools. After all, if you don't want the Jew or the Catholic sharing with you power, joining the executive suite or the State Department, you do well to keep him away from the training grounds. And the South, our South, knew exactly what it was about when it set up the system of separate but unequal schools, academic institutions for the white, vocational institutions for the Negro, Out of the white schools would come the elite, but an elite today requires trained garage men, trained hospital orderlies, salesmen in the stores, in order that their life may be fully graceful. So you need some schooling, but not the same schooling. Anti-intellectualism, obscurantism, is a flaw that runs straight through the center of Western civilization. And over the years, it has developed a rationale, a justification of its own. Education is corrupt, is a corrupt enterprise. Education destroys the native integrity, the simplicity, the wholeheartedness of the child. Send your child to college and he'll come back bedraggled, dirty. Somehow, not quite the fine young man you sent him away. Simplicity is equated with saintliness. Intelligence undermines somehow innocence. And so we have in the Western tradition the assumption that the wise man is the Socrates. He is the traitor to his society. He is the man who seeds doubt, not the man who builds up the sinews of the society and establishes the basis, the foundation of the home. Education corrupts. Saintliness is simplicity. And so you had in the Middle Ages groups like the Ignorantines, religious brotherhoods who refused to admit into the confraternity anyone who had any degree of theological training. The assumption was that once you were trained, you no longer could be single-hearted with your God. And you have still in the United States the Amish, the Mennonites, who refuse to educate their children beyond a certain level, because beyond that level, there are the doubts. There is the great cloud of confusion, and their communities can sustain themselves only in the rustic simplicity which they have known heretofore. Throughout history, one of the constant figures of ridicule is the educated fool. You find him in Greek tragedy, you find him in the modern comic strip. You find him in the attack of the McCarthys of every age, the eggheads, those much maligned people. Somehow they are different then, set apart from. They know all that must be done for the future of the world to build a utopia, but they cannot manage their own lives. You've heard it and heard it again and again and again. We fear the educated man. We deny education to the masses. We are afraid of being thrust into a future for which we are not prepared. Western man has a long history of turning away from, of being fearful of denying to himself and to his children and to his community the blessing of education. Obscurantism can be found in every society and every age in Western culture. Obscurantism lies as one of the basic bedrock attitudes of most cultures, save one, and that one is our own. Judaism is the one scholar-loving culture in Western civilization. Judaism is the one intellectualist religion. Judaism is the one religion which insists that one must make his study a fixed duty. Asei Toras HaKeva. And Judaism made no claims that the simple man was the saintly man. Einam Haaretz Hasid. The boor, the fool, the ignorant cannot be a pious man. The rabbis used to say that there are four things which grace life, four actions of a man which grace life here and now, and which add to his grace in the world to come. The first is to honor one's father and one's mother. The second is to make peace between a man and his neighbor. The third is to do deeds of loving kindness. And the fourth is to study, to be busy with Torah, with learning. And they added Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. The study, the learning process, is the equal of all of the other virtues. Judaism glorified the educated man. The word rabbi means simply teacher. The synagogue was so involved in the educational enterprise that the very name it took onto itself, shul, was shule, school. If a Jewish father refused to educate his child, he could be coerced to do so by the courts. 2,000 years ago, we created the first mandatory public educational system. The rabbis debated long and loud whether or not a man needed to abandon his books if the hour of daily worship intruded upon his study time. Search history and you'll find very few illiterate Jews. You will find in Judaism a tendency to overestimate the intellectually nimble. Families used to want as their son-in-law the brightest of the young scholars in the yeshiva. And there was a tendency to reward far beyond its worth the photographic mind and the agile intellect. And you will find in our ethical literature any number of warnings against this kind of adulation. But the point is that ours is the one culture in which this kind of overestimate of the scholar could take place. In the Roman civilization, the scholar was usually a Greek slave. In medieval times, the magister sat at the very foot of the table. In modern America, the educated class is among, until very recently, was certainly the least honored and certainly the least rewarded monetarily of all the major professional classes. But Israel glorified the sage. Judaism was a schoolhouse. The Jew looked on his religion as Torah, as teaching. And he knew that the teaching and the worship and the deed, the study, the ritual, and righteous acts were the very foundation stones of his religion. I've often wondered where this tradition began. How it is that Judaism, uniquely of the cultures of the West, took on this intellectualist tradition. It wasn't always so. If you look at the early history of the Bible, you find non-intellectual heroes, Abraham, Jacob, Moses, David, Solomon, Isaiah, Amos, great men. But none of them is associated with a school. None of them glorifies the learning process. In pre-exilic Judaism, when the prophets begin to attack the cult, the ritual, in the name of righteousness, they talk of many virtues, of justice and peace and of obligation and duty, but never of the duty of learning. The educational emphasis in Jewish life, it appears, began with the exile, when the Jews were driven out of Judea by the Babylonians in the late 6th century B.C. The temple was in ruins, and our fathers had to find some way of continuing their corporate way of life, which was not associated with the temple ritual. And apparently they created for a while surrogate sacrifices. They would come at the appointed hours when sacrifices had been offered in the temple, and they would sing the hymns and the psalms which had been sung at those times. But they quickly became tired of this routine. It was not enough. They wanted more. And at some point in exilic or post-exilic times, their leaders began to read to them from the scrolls of the law. They took from the Ark, as we take from our Ark, the Torah scroll. They read it and they interpreted it. Something of our intellectualist tradition grows from the simple fact of the Torah having been written down, being available for comment, discussion, and interpretation. But that's not a satisfactory explanation. It's too accidental for something which is so basic. I believe that the real reason lies in the unique nature of our faith. There's a line in the book of Proverbs, which I read to you this morning. Yirat Adonai Reishis Da'at. The beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. Knowledge begins in religion. And I think this is true historically in our Jewish tradition. All the other religions of antiquity began on the Oriental model. God was the despot, and he demanded absolute, abject subservience, obedience from the worshiper. The cults were royal cults, the cults of the upper class, and they were imposed upon the people. O Obedience, submission. These were the virtues inculcated by the ancient faith. Judaism began as the search of a people. Abraham leaving his home and traveling outward. He was outward bound, looking for something. God, a new way of life. Judaism is based on a covenant, on a contractual relationship between God and man. Now, Israel was a junior partner, and the obligations rested heavily on Israel, but Israel was a partner. We had certain rights. Abraham could argue with God. Isaiah could say to God, come and let us reason together. Our people brought their pride as well as their piety to their faith. Faith was a search as well as the submission. And a people that has some pride and some dignity, which searches and seeks to understand, I believe inevitably comes to be one that glorifies learning. For learning is the dignity of a man. Learning makes you stand tall. Learning makes you, in a sense, the equal of the divine, as far as man can be equal to the divine. For God is wisdom, and man becomes godlike as he masters the wisdom of the world. For wisdom is power, and wisdom is knowledge, and wisdom is the capacity to act with some degree of effect. Whatever the reasons, by post-exilic times, Judaism was founded on wisdom. The leader was the scholar. The synagogue was a schoolhouse. The virtue was Torah, training, study, learning. Now, all this is history. And one might say it's past history. The world seems to have caught up to the old Jewish emphasis on education. The human workhorse is, in the 20th century, obsolete. A nation which does not mine the genetic potential God's gift to us in its population will atrophy, wither. The greatest treasury a nation has today is its human resource. But it's a resource which must be unlocked, and it can be unlocked only by training, by education. Education is the fastest growing enterprise in the world next to warfare. Some say that it is that race which will determine the fate of man. We want more education, better education. Two generations ago, it was unusual for a man to graduate from high school. Today, the small percentage who do not graduate from high school, the dropouts, we consider to be a great social problem. Education is offered to us as the panacea for almost all of our social ills. One would say that the world has caught up to the ancient Hebrew vision. But I wonder. For history is rarely discontinuous. And an obscurantist tradition, an anti-intellectual tradition, so deeply mined into the Western way of life, probably has simply gone underground. And when we look more carefully at learning in the 20th century, we see something very interesting. Where the Jews spoke of Torah as the search for values, as a humanistic enterprise, we speak today of education as a fact-seeking enterprise, as the gaining of certain techniques, of certain skills. Half the world seeks to train the mind while washing the brain. Half the world seeks to have technicians for its plants and for its armies, but does not want men who have the critical facilities to criticize the ideology, the founding doctrine. And in America, how little of our educational enterprise is devoted to thinking. Learning, yes. Memorizing, certainly. What is a national merit scholar? Is a young man or a young woman who can choose which of five factual answers to a factual question is correct with a great degree of consistency. A National Merit Scholar is not a certificate of character, of quality, of dignity, or even really of ability. It's simply how good a teaching machine How good a human computer is that particular child? If you look at our educational system, you realize that increasingly it has turned away from that which provokes thought, from that which is which are questions of basic value, and has turned towards simply the engineering of human skills. We place a child before a teaching machine. IBM or some other company provide us with the rolls of tapes, and the child ultimately becomes that tape that can spin and spin and spin over again and give us the very highly sophisticated answers that we require. But are these really the answers that we require? What good to us are most of our experts? They know how to do their narrow job. They know how to follow along and build a highway straight through a community, through all of its beauty and all of its stable neighborhoods. And they don't know how to build a community or to save human values. They know how to save a life, but not how to let a life die when there is no hope for that life and only pain. They know how to teach us how to learn more, but not how to teach us to think, to be more in and of ourselves. I'm frightened by the prospect of a generation of narrowly circumscribed experts, each one highly capable of his narrow field, none of them knowing how their field must relate to that which is ultimate and basic, human value, human need, society. The rabbis used to say, "Thou shalt not make the Torah a spade to dig with." Torah was not vocational. It was not professional. If a man wanted to be a craftsman, a guildsman, a doctor, a lawyer, he learned this by apprenticeship. Now, this kind of process is obviously impossible in the 20th century. But certainly we could bring more of Torah into our educational system. Certainly we could give the teachers in our secondary schools a certain amount of freedom, give them tenure, give them the freedom to challenge with their children the basic values of our society. We send a man to college, and we give him one or two general courses in history or Western civilization, and beyond that he specializes for 6 or 7 years without asking the basic questions. Why? What are we building? Where are we going? Of what use is all this information? What larger responsibility do I have as a scientist and a technician except to push further the boundaries of human knowledge? Torah was a lifelong enterprise. It began in these schools. It continued throughout life. Education today is an increasingly narrow enterprise. The man learns his profession and he continues to read in his profession, and he rarely reads beyond the boundaries of his profession. One way to turn the human race into a group of Pavlov-trained dogs who respond to certain cues, who can perform certain complicated functions, all for the leader, all in direction, when the bell rings, is to continue unhesitatingly the present trend in education. For it is a trend which has been created by the anti-intellectualist authorities who fear to have their power, their traditions, their attitudes contested. Ours is a world in revolutionary change. Children are growing into a world far different than anything we can really imagine. To bind them to the attitudes that are ours is to huddle them, to put chains on their ankles, really to prevent them from creating any hope, any real hope for their world. We need to teach them to think, to challenge, yes, to challenge our faith, yes, to challenge our moral standards, yes, to really think through what they mean by right and wrong, truth and the lie. We offer them very little opportunity to do so. Schools say it's the home's responsibility. The home says it's the religious school's responsibility. The religious school says we have so little time. And the child absorbs like a sponge. But where does he think? Where is he challenged to doubt? Where is he challenged to grope, to seek, to find? What ought we to be creating in the child who is now in school? What do we want? What are the marks of an educated man? Are they degrees? Each of us has known what the tradition calls a chamor noses svarim, an ass loaded with books. A man with every conceivable academic degree who has no sense whatsoever. Is that what the mark of an educated man? Do we measure an educated man by the number of feet of books in his home? By the fact he has a photographic memory and can recall title and author and chapter and verse and character and fact? Is that an educated man? Is an educated man a man who can perform a certain complicated electronic circuitry, make it work? Simply that his fingers are nimble, that he can read a diagram and carry it out? Is that an educated man? I submit to you that there are three standards by which we can judge if a man is educated or not. The first is this. Is he religious? Is he religious? Does he have a faith in man, in values, goals? Religion's a terrible goad. It forces you to seek, forces you to relate fact to life. Is he religious? And the second standard of an educated man is this. Is he critical? Is he judicious? It's easy to absorb, to be the sponge. But most of what's told us is told us for an ulterior purpose. Men want to convince us that we ought to vote for them, do what they want us to do, agree with them. The truly educated man has the ability to judge each man's profession to him against his religious standards, against what he feels to be right and wrong, good and evil. An educated man is a man with a profound faith. He's a man who's profoundly skeptical. But his skepticism is not that kind of sophomoric skepticism which simply denies all the values of life, because it's tied to a faith, it's tied to positive values. He simply questions why you are badgering him to agree with you. And the third mark of an educated man is he flexible? Is he aware? Is he alert? Judaism pioneered what's being called today continuing education, book learning from cradle to the grave. Most of us spend a few years in college in an intellectual hothouse, and we got a few preconceptions and prejudices, and we got a smattering of some philosophy, and we've judged everything that's happened to us since by that smattering of ignorance. The Jew read every day of his life. He did only as much as he needed to do in business in order to be freed for the debate, the challenge of other men who were thinking. The pleasure of reading, the pleasure of ideas. And I see very little of this in our 20th century. Each of us plows along his own furrow, straight and true towards some financial goal. But ideas, they belong in college. Flexibility of mind. How many of us have ever changed our basic attitudes towards values and towards life? Yet how can we not have changed course in a world which is as roiling, as tumultuous as our world is? Are the values of your early 20s really satisfactory 30 and 40 years later? In the space age, the technological age, and the age of the explosion of population, there's been more learning, more factual information in those 30 years than all of pre-recorded history. And yet we hold on to the simplicities. Faith, judiciousness, awareness, flexibility. These are the marks of an educated man. And the educated man is not a man who lives in an ivory tower. In our tradition, the rav, the scholar, the teacher, lived in and with and for. He entered the arena. He debated politics. He was the judge. He was involved in the legal system. He was very much concerned with the political climate of the day. He knew that there are very few absolutes in that arena. But he knew also that men needed the larger perspective and the broader horizons in order to make effective judgments. Action, awareness, alertness, faith. These are the marks of an educated man. Let me close by saying simply this. Every Jewish boy and girl must go to college, or so every Jewish parent says. I doubt it. I doubt that the best Torah, the best education, is available today in a mass seminar hall, the television set here, loudspeakers all around the room, and a professor reading from the book that he published 2 years ago. Education involves contact, the clash of ideas, search for values. It can take place in the business office and in the marketplace quite as easily as at the university. Can take place in the silence of the night. We confront the printed page, someone else's ideas, and wrestle with it and judge it. It can take place in the quiet of the living room and we sit with a parent or a friend and debate and discuss and wrestle with and gnaw at an idea. College prevents us with certificates of employment. A little more. And our world badly needs the Academy of Torah, the informal ways of learning, the hours of reading, the hours of discussion, the flash of debate. For it is here that we learn. Kol malam dai hiskalti, the old teacher said, I learned from all of my pupils, and I learned still more from the humble people in the marketplace. Send your son to college, or your daughter. But encourage him to get an education, and not simply a training. Amen.